Good morning.
Good morning.
See if I can. Dr. Weiss told you my name is Pam Barber, and I am related to the infamous Dr. Barber. He is my husband. We spell our name B-A-R-B-O-U-R for everyone who looks at my name and says, "Do I know you?" That's how we are. Joe, my husband, teaches here at the seminary, and I'm sure most of you are probably familiar with that. I myself am an RN. I specialize in geriatrics. My undergraduate degree is in gerontology, so I also look at geriatrics and gerontology together. And that's what I'd like to talk about today, because part of the aspects of aging is a very difficult subject to talk about. It's difficult to talk about from a nurse's perspective, from a doctor's perspective, from a pastor's perspective, because if by now that we haven't figured this out, the perspective is all of us are getting older every day. It's a family relationship. There's grandparents, there's parents, there's children, there's great-grandchildren. We all have to work together to get through this process. We have to be able to say to each other, this is what I would like to do when I get older. We have come to a point as we are aging, and aging very quickly, that part of our life has to be in perspective. You have to have a goal. My goal is hopefully to retire with my husband someday and be able to enjoy our grandchildren, if God blesses us with grandchildren, and not too soon and not too late. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of variables in everything that happens to you in life. So with this in mind, this is how I would like to approach it. First of all, am I on the right one? This is kind of an interesting overview of how aging is looked at and expectancies. Statistics of the aging population, which everyone's heard a million times, and you'll probably hear however many more speakers there are. But first of all, in 1840, the average life expectancy was 40 years old. In that day and time, you could expect to live to be 40 if you were an average individual. In 1960, it was boosted up to 66. It's kind of interesting to look at how we can see how we've improved maybe medical care. In 1985, life expectancy is 75. And the average 65-year-old can expect to live to 81 and a half years. So currently, 30 million people are over the age of 65. In the year 2010, there will be 39 million over the age of 65. And in 2030, there will be 64 million people over the age of 65. And in the year 2050, there will be 70 million people over the age of 65. The trends are there. This is the current issue that everyone has to address. So we're looking at the 85 and plus age is now becoming the fastest growing population in the United States. So it's kind of interesting to think that in this, as we're looking ahead, in 1997, at 85 years of age and over, growing faster than live births. What does that tell you? For many of us who are in this field, it tells us that we have to almost take a different perspective of how we approach what's going to be important for us to do in the future. Things have changed so drastically. We look at business opportunities in the elderly, and I'm sure everyone here has seen those business opportunities arise. You're seeing residential cares, you're seeing parish nurses, you're seeing hospice care, you're seeing all these types of cares are emerging to care for this generation of 85 plus. Who's going to take care of them? That's the big question. Who is going to take care of these people at 85 plus years? If this is the fastest growing population, then where are the caregivers? Caregivers are all of us. It's going to be community and church-based eventually. It's going to have to be. There's no other way to support such a large amount of elderly people who will require some assistance without looking into community-type services. So With that in mind, we also need to look at some of the other things that these statistics tell us. One thing is that now retirement has become an established institution, and more people are leaving work at an earlier age. For the older adult that wishes to continue to work, unemployment and age discrimination are still big problems in the United States. Many older workers who are unemployed stay out of work much longer than a younger person. So we have to deal with retirement in very many ways. Hopefully, we'll be the ones that will be able to retire, have the luxury of travel, leisure, financial security, and good health. I mean, that's what our wish would be for everyone. But unfortunately, that's not how it works. So one in four persons that are retired have some type of a limitation. Okay? It may not be a severe limitation, but they have a type of limitation. Some of this may be as minor as an arthritic joint that causes them some discomfort, causes them an inability to be able to move quickly, or it may be as severe as Alzheimer's disease or a terminal illness of cancer or even heart disease. So placing the disability into perspective, if there are 30 million people over the age of 65 now, that is 7.5 million people with some type of limitation. And when we reach 64 million people at the age of 65, that leaves 16 million people with some type of a limitation or a disability. That's a phenomenal amount of people that we're going to have to be able to help in some form or fashion. One of the other interesting facts about aging is about women. If you can't see that, just holler or okay. Women will spend 17 years caring for dependent children and 18 years caring for dependent parents. It's an interesting fact. How can you, if you fathom yourself taking care of your children and thinking about all the issues that you have with raising children, think that you may have years longer than that to help a dependent parent. The problem with right now that we're facing, besides just the care issue, is that approximately 3/4 of all non-institutional care is privately financed by the elderly and or their relatives. In the job market today, for many people, many professional people who now do not have the type of income that they were planning to have at this point in their life, this is an extremely heavy burden laid upon them, because someone has to take care of these people. And if you are that person, if you happen to have the parent that needs that type of care, and there are no financial ways for them to be taken care of other than your assistance, you will do anything to help them. It leaves us all in a very, it's a predicament. I don't know how else to describe it at this point. It's something we're all going to have to work on. Duration of care ranges from 1 to 43 years. The interesting thing about the care ranges from 1 to 43 years is I had the wonderful ability to be called for jury duty last week. And I sat in this room, and there were probably 300 people or so, and we're sitting there, and I sat next to this lovely elderly lady named Marilyn. And I was writing, trying to think, what am I going to talk about? What am I going to talk about? So I was telling her what I was doing. She said, "Oh, my mother-in-law just died in July." And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." She said, "Well, she lived with us for 52 years. And I was thinking, 52 years. I said, how did that happen? Just because I didn't know what else to say. I was like, 52. Kind of in that predicament. She said, "My mother-in-law moved in with us 1 year after we were married. because her husband had died. She had one disability when she moved in. She was losing her sight. Besides losing her sight, she then later had a stroke. After the stroke, she fell and broke her hip. This is over the course of the 52 years of what this woman has dealt with. She also, in the meantime, raised 5 children. She did not work outside the home, obviously, because she had more than enough work inside the home. But she actually took care of this mother-in-law the entire time of her life, except for the last 2 months. So these are the burdens that are being placed. It's not actually a burden, but it is a burden. It's a physical burden, if nothing else. It is physically hard to have to take care of someone with this many disabilities in your own home, plus raise children, plus do laundry, cook, whatever. So this is kind of an interesting statistic to see what's happening with the women right now. And then we're going to look at and see, and I am basing this information from gerontological books, not just off my head, guys, because the next one is about men, and I'm sure somebody's going to say, huh. Men think in terms of financial responsibility or how to buy the solution. Is that true? Okay, so it's a different perspective. Men come from that perspective. They're the wage earners. They're the people that have to work the hardest to solve the problems, to raise the family. So they're still, after you've raised your family and something happens to your parents or to your wife's parents, you may be put in this spot of trying to figure out a financial responsibility to help buy the solution. The other interesting thing is women view the problem as an emotional responsibility. I think that happens all the time. It's very hard for me as a caregiver and working with geriatrics to think that I could ever say to my mother or my mother-in-law, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, I couldn't take care of you. It would be my emotional responsibility in my own mind to at least try and assist them. Now hopefully we will see ways to work within the church, within the community, within other areas that we may be able to help relieve some of this and solve some of these problems. But an American's cherished strong tradition of encouraging grown children to support their parents. That is still a concept that is passed down. How many of you have said to your children, whatever you do, don't put me in a nursing home? You used to hear it a lot. Or whatever happens, if something happens to me, I don't care what you do. Excuse me. I don't care what you do. I don't care if you don't come see me. I'll be okay. The big guilt trip. So how many, these are interesting things of how we kind of place this onto our children. And we learn to do it at a very early age because our children see us deal with our parents. And our parents have dealt with their parents. It is a tradition. It's a generational thing that's coming up that we're going to have to look at. And we're going to discuss a little bit about the life cycle a little bit later and talk about how some of these things are passed on from generation to generation. The problem of elder care is similar to those faced by working parents with young children. But the most important difference is that there's little precedence in handling care of the elder person. And since the care is so highly charged with emotional issues, Americans cherish the strong tradition of encouraging grown children to support their parents. And another significant problem is the emotional drain on the person providing the elder care. Excuse me. Depression is another common problem for those providing the care of the elderly parent. So not only do we have to worry about depressed elderly, now we have to worry about the children being depressed that are taking care of this person. I'm sorry, my allergies are killing me today. Here. Okay. (Clears throat) Okay, first I would like to go, I'm just going to run through this real fast, but it's kind of an interesting theory on aging. There are basically four theories out there that are kind of looked at periodically, and the first one is cohorts. That older people must be understood both in today's context and in the context of major historical events that have shaped their lives. And that is important to know, because what makes people tick is what's happened to them as they've grown up. So for my generation, the Vietnam War will be a very significant influence as far as cohorts of people aging. We've been through, and who knows what's going to be for our children at this point, because there's so many issues coming up. Health reform is a big issue. There's a million things coming up that may have a tendency to make this elderly population be a certain way. Life events. The life event theory explains aging as a product of the way people have adjusted and adapted to the usual life experiences. Life events are closely linked with age or the stage of the life cycle. And we will discuss the life cycle a little bit later, but it's interesting to know that the events of your life develop how you're going, how you theory yourself as an aged person. If it's been a good experience for you to see, to have raised other, or to have watched your parents take care of their parents, this theory, this life event cycle, is developed in your mind, then that's something that you would like to do for your parents and vice versa, and it continues generational. The next thing is developmental theory, and that's the theory that life begins at birth and ends at death. We go through cycles composed of infancy, early childhood, puberty, adolescence, young adult, maturity, and old age. And this theory assumes a progression to completeness and expects movements towards a specific human state, which means developmental theory assumes that increased deterioration is a normal process. Okay, now these are theories. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. The fourth one is the biomedical, and this is attention to deficits likely to occur in older adults. These deficits are approached with professional attitudes and programs aimed at accommodations, thank you, rather than adaptation. Meaning this is what biomedical research has done. We're not so worried about getting to the cure sometimes, but we're worried to how to adapt to make people function in some area, like knee replacements, hip replacements. That's a biomedical response. We can't necessarily solve the problem that some people's joints will wear out. There's no way to solve that problem. So our response is biomedical. And that's another theory that's been brought up several times. This is just one of my little, I like this one. Most of all, growing older is a selective experience in survival. I think that's true for everyone because there are you have choices and you've made choices. Hopefully they're good choices. Hopefully you've decided to have a healthy lifestyle or that you've decided to work on areas of concern as you become an older person. That's your selective experience in survival. You want to survive to see the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren or to have this experience. So these are choices that we make. There's a couple of things that I wanted to run through as far as public policy for the elderly. And just in an interesting type for a historical perspective is that it does require an understanding for us what politics has done for the elderly. First of all, the challenge of helping older adults is more has become a more extended helping approach than previously thought of in public policy. Of course, the first Social Security legislation was in 1935, which was an attempt to help older people make better use of their existing funds. But the next public policy that even affected the older person was 20 years later in 1965. So for it kind of tells you where politics has come from. They're looking at social programs as being a response to the aging population. Well, as we're seeing now, social programs are not going to be able to carry the load of 64 million people over the age of 65. So we have ourselves in quite a quandary of what to do. Also in 1965, the Medicaid program was passed, which at that time was to help the poor elderly, but it has also been expanded now to women, children, infants, and I'm sure everyone's aware of Medicaid. Or in Illinois, I believe it's public aid is the same difference. Medicaid systems started to pay for nursing home care in July of 1976. Prior to that, it was either based on your ability to pay or there were no resources. There were some grant money available, which were like cash grants, so it's a very nominal amount of money, like $300 or $400, which kind of helps you sometimes put into perspective what has happened to the industry as far as changes of nursing home care, which we're going to also hopefully get to. There's six basic aging rules, and this is taken from Dr. Fry's book on aging well. His discussion is to age well, you have to be able to maintain independence. Maintaining independence may be just as much as a preservation of your vitality or making a choice, feeling like you have a choice. There's some things that you can't ever change. You may not be able to be totally independent as you age, but you can make choices. That is a feeling of independence. Healthy lifestyles are critical to maintaining good health. To keep active, exercise regularly at least 15 minutes, 4 days a week. All of us have been to the gym this morning, right? And exercise the mind as well as the body. Sometimes it's very much forgotten. When you say exercise, of course, everyone thinks of, well, I don't, but my kids do, pumping iron, doing whatever they do in the gym, I don't know. So that's what they're looking at, is keeping healthy. But there's a lot more to keeping healthy besides just physical. We have a 106-year-old lady who can play the dice game, what's that, cribbage, that where you count faster than her 89-year-old daughter. Yahtzee, yeah. They count the dice. She can add them up. She's fast. Her daughter gets so frustrated when her mother says, "I'm tired of playing this game." She's like, "Mother, you have to do this. This is stimulating to your mind." She said, "My mind's been stimulated long enough." It's not a grumpy approach. It's actually, she probably is tired. But the fact that she can still do it, she knows she can still do it. The daughters come every day and help her to stimulate some type of activity. Be enthusiastic. Be enthusiastic about anything. Help these people be enthusiastic. If it's about making a choice, if it's about seeing a person, if it's about going to church, if it's about going to anything, be enthusiastic. We tend to lose that as we get older sometimes because it's almost like, that's corny, we don't need to do that, we've got so much to do, I'm so stressed out, I can't stand this, da-da-da-da-da. And we lose that enthusiasm. Life should be exciting. It has to be exciting. Or it would certainly be a boring place to live, right? And pride. You have to have pride. There's nothing wrong with our little ladies that are 90 to 100 years old putting on their makeup in the morning, dressing nicely, the men dressing nicely. It may be in sweatsuits, as Dr. Weiss brought out yesterday, because of the fact that it is hard to zip and button and do all this paraphernalia. There's nothing wrong with wearing a sweatsuit and looking nice and taking some pride in your appearance and pride in what you can do. You may not be able to run a marathon. You may not be able to cook a 9-course meal or whatever, but you still have to have pride in what you're able to do. And that may be just helping someone by listening to them. It may be by sharing any type of information with them. And be an individual. Don't lose that individual. We tend to do that in the medical system very quickly. The gallbladder down the hall, the Alzheimer's patients in this wing, the confused people over here, we tend to group them into categories of diseases. When we do that, they lose their individuality and they also lose their ability to be that individual. And it's something we all need to focus on as you make calls to people in the hospital. I'm sure sometimes your first thought is, what does that disease mean? You almost think of that instead of, what is that person in the bed feeling? So it's very important to stay in tune with the feelings of these individuals. The next thing I wanted to talk about a little bit are options and choices for these elderly people. Used to be when people were old in the 1800s and there was no family around, no one could take care of them, they were placed in institutions that were called almshouses or poorhouses. That's how nursing homes actually got their start. Then they were moved, at one point in time, elderly people were moved in with orphanage children. In the St. Louis area, that was at St. Paul de Pere. That was the very first place that elderly were housed with orphan children. And they decided this doesn't work. It's not what they need. So we then decided, well, we need to make some other options, and they came up with nursing homes. For a long time, that was your only choice, was a nursing home. Now, this is just a list that I've just kind of come up with, and I'm sure there's probably more options here than I'm aware of, because every day there's a businessman out there who comes up with the opportunity to do something to help someone out. So the first, senior housing. Senior housing is a great idea. As you have seen, I don't know if you're aware that like in North County and Illinois, there's places where old schools have been converted into senior housing. They're basically independent living units, apartments, where all of the elderly, you have to be over 65 to qualify. It's usually a screening process. There are some funds available for this other than private pay. They have Medicaid funds available and sometimes what they call a cash grant, which can be applied for. Boarding homes. These are options mainly in rural areas. We do still have some in the city, but very few. Boarding homes are where people have bought big houses and converted their own rooms upstairs into a place for elderly people to go that need some type of care. This is strictly a private pay basis. It's also strictly based on their ability to function. To be in a boarding home, they have to be able to be self-care, basically. They just need supervision. Adult daycare, it's a wonderful option. It's a wonderful option for Alzheimer's patients. It's an absolute dream come true for people who are trying to balance their family and their parents. It's a place to take your elderly person for 8 hours or up to 8 hours. Some of them are now extending hours to 12 hours a day. They will feed them two meals. Sometimes they only feed them one. I mean, there's a lot of options. There's a lot of variables in this. But it's something that people have become very astute in doing. Daycares are becoming a great option. It's not institutional care. Home health care. It's an option that's paid for under Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare does pay a percentage of it, usually 80%. Well, actually, they cover 100% of the visit. But if you have equipment in your home, then you may have to pay the other 20% that Medicare does not pay. Homemaker care is another Medicare and Medicaid service to the elderly. And this is where someone can come in and clean their house, help them keep their home up. It's light cleaning, maybe grocery shopping, maybe sometimes they also provide a transportation service in the homemaker chore service. Assisted living. It's an independent living unit, but it's where there is someone in the building that could help them if they need it. Assisted living units are the up-and-coming rage of the of the country right now, especially on the East Coast. Residential care facilities, they're going up on every corner. Right now, there is not a certificate of need required for residential care facilities, and you see them going up everywhere. There's different levels of residential care, but basically, they have to be mentally intact so that they can perform their own task. And this is strictly private pay at this point. There are no other options for payment. Hospice, of course, is a wonderful service that's provided by many hospital-based institutions. There are freestanding institutions that also provide this care. It's for terminally ill patients. It provides a pastor, it provides a counselor, it provides a nurse, an aide. It provides everything that they would actually need in their time of in dying with dignity is the goal of the hospice nurse. The nursing home care is strictly institutional care. Respite care is a choice for, say you keep your parents at your house all the time, you want to take a vacation, you can opt for respite care. Most nursing homes in the all around have this type of care. You can put your elderly person into a nursing home for up to eight hours or up to 2 to 3 weeks. And when you when you do that, it is strictly a private pay basis and it's based strictly on their need. After we have gone through I know this is like a whirlwind version of geriatrics and gerontology rolled into one, but aging is often depicted as the physical and psychological adjustments to process beyond anyone's control. It's kind of deep. It sounds like something my husband would say. Because it is. It's a psychological adjustment that you have to come up with. I'm sure that for anyone in this room who's ever gotten up with an arthritic joint and pain has said, this is the pits. Aging is horrible. Sure, there's parts of it that are horrible, but if we all adjust psychologically to the fact that this is going to happen and we can adjust and survive and be productive, it would sure make things a lot easier for us to age in a healthy lifestyle. And this is one of the big goals we have to look at for the 21st century. We have to say, healthy, you have to age healthy. Some of us may work till we're 70 or 80. Oh, horrible thought, isn't it? But it's very true. Some of us may have to work till we're 70 or 80 years old. So these are things, this is something we're going to have to look at. It's just, it's food for thought. The other, we were talking about the life cycle, and the reason that I really wanted to bring this up is because the emotional context for the elderly, as for all members of a family, involve at least 3 generations. You cannot make a decision in your family that is not going to involve at least the generation before you or after you, or 2 generations past you. So when you take this into consideration, this is when we come into life choices. We need to discuss now, at our age, what we want to do, what our goals are with our spouse, and amongst our children. We have a tendency, and especially these stout Germans who are very private, who don't share this information with their family members. You may find yourself in a bind as they try and make decisions for you as you become an older person. Well, Mom never said. I don't know what she wants. I don't have a clue what Dad wants. He's never, ever told me. These are things that we're going to have to break down. We have to learn to be, we have to all participate in all parts of the life cycle for our own good and for the good of our family. Because mental health is very important. We have to make hard choices. There are 5% of the population at any given time in nursing homes. Institutional care is a very hard concept. And that's one of the last things that I really wanted to discuss was about nursing home care. And not just because I do it, but because it is a very important part of aging. Hopefully, it will remain at 5%. By the year 2010, the projections are 7% of people will be institutionalized in nursing homes. But the one thing that you have to understand is that this decision has to be made with the family, and it needs to be made with concern for the person making that decision. It does not have to be a guilt trip, and it should not be a guilt trip. There's a time when there are no other choices. There's a time when you physically cannot do the care that's required anymore. And that's why nursing homes are here. And believe me, they've come a long way. There are still bad nursing homes. I'm not telling you that they're all good. There are still bad ones. But what I would like to do in the last 5 minutes is tell you a few things to look at. First of all, there's a lot of choices. There's a lot of nursing homes. There's some that have chandeliers bigger than these hanging in the lobby. There's some that have limo transportation. There's some that are very basic. You need to develop what type of care this person needs and how they're going to get it. What's the best option for them? What's the best option for you financially? Secondly, be informed. Be informed of what is going on. Do you know that right now the nursing home industry is the most legislated industry in the world? If you understand that, then you can understand some of these political battles that are going on health care reform. You can understand why politicians are so touchy when the AARP shows up on their doorstep. Don't underestimate the power of the elderly people who are out there voting and making decisions. But you need to be informed. If you're a pastor, you need to make sure that people are telling your church members information about what is available. Because it is a very, very emotional, hard response. There is no easy way to do this. So if we give information and we have an opportunity to share this information, it sure makes choices a lot easier. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask. You can ask anything. We may not have the answer, but you can ask it. See for yourself. Don't be one of these people who say, I heard when your mother was in the nursing home, da-da-da-da-da. And you get these stories, the horror stories that go around. Yes, horror stories are there, unfortunately. It's people dealing with people. Unfortunately, not everyone has a Christian attitude towards people like they should. It is very unfortunate. It does happen. But go see for yourself. And be supportive of the family that has to make this choice. There is no easy way to make the choice. Be supportive. Don't be opinionated. It's very easy to say, if that were my mom, I'd keep her at home. That wouldn't be a problem. Or if that were my mother-in-law, I'd never let her go into that nursing home. Or you could say, if that were my mother-in-law, I'd be glad to put her in that nursing home. But, you know, it could vary. The last thing that I wanted to go over is just how to make an informed decision. These are things that you need to look at. Number one, what type of care is actually needed? Do not make the mistake of institutionalizing someone that really doesn't need full institutional care. Once you put someone in a nursing home, we have this phenomena of people walking into our nursing home and saying, where's my wheelchair? Well, you walked in. Don't I get a wheelchair? Well, yes, ma'am, we'll give you a wheelchair. I want a green wheelchair. They come in with a color in mind. I'm in a wheelchair, I deserve this, and now someone has to take care of me. That is the concept we are trying very hard to get away from, but it still exists. So type of care is very important. Payment choices. There's Medicare, there's Medicaid, there's veteran benefits. There are private pay. There are nursing home insurance programs. Some are good. Some are very, very bad. Be very cautious with long-term care policies right now. Visit the home. Visit it more than once. Don't just go one time. There are times that a nursing home will have odors. There are times when people will look messy. These are people, and these things happen. So don't be scared to death because you go in and you smell something like, ooh, this is what I always heard about nursing homes, they all stink. Sure, some do stink, and there's a big difference. When you walk in the front door and you can't hardly stand up, then that's usually a bad sign. But making a tour around a building, you may have different odors of things that have happened in the facility. So visit more than once. Take a list of questions. Take them for the social worker and the administrator. Ask the social worker, what does my mother have to do to get on Medicaid? And do you take Medicaid? And if my mother pays 3 years of private pay, are you going to kick her out when she becomes Medicaid? Some homes do not keep residents after their private pay status. That is very important to know because you develop a relationship with these people. You treat them as you would want to be treated. You learn to love these people very, very much. And it's very difficult for them to adjust to changing because they get used to being in a certain place. So it's a very important thing to know. Activities. Do they have activities? What type of activities? Do they have an activity director? Do they take them on out trips? Can you participate? Can you help? If you play the piano, can you do music one day? Policy for Patient Self-Directive Acts. And the main thing that I wanted to bring up, that is required by law now for them to ask you to fill out a Patient Care Self-Determination Act. But one thing you need to be aware of is that there are still very many religious choices available out there. And with the Self-Determination Act, it's brought up usually prior to on admission. The fact that some people have written in this act, I do not require or will not have tube feeding or hydration / is a problem for some homes. It is a problem for our home. We do not function that way. You may come to us and not have a tube feeding if you are terminally ill or if there is a physical reason, a physical reason that you could not obtain a feeding anymore, that it would do you more harm. We tell you up front, if you want to lay in a bed and starve to death, you may not do it in our nursing homes. So you need to know enough to ask these questions. The other thing is, ask about the doctor. Doctor. It's very interesting. Some doctors participate very well in nursing home. We have some excellent medical directors out there, and I'm sure you can tell by the caliber of doctors that have talked to us today that there is a lot of interest in geriatrics. But it is a very important question. Can you talk to that doctor and can you get answers? Visiting hours and telephones. Telephones are a hot issue in nursing homes. I don't know why, but they are. Some people want telephones, some people don't want telephones. But the one thing about it is, it's just something to know, to ask to go in. Can I have a telephone in my room? It doesn't sound like a big deal, but what does that do? It's an independent choice for the resident. Something they can choose. And the last thing is, you might want to visit or see a meal, because one of the most important things that happens in a nursing home is that everyone can sit down together and have a meal and an interaction between people. It's a very important aspect to look at when you visit nursing homes. And I'm out of time, and I really appreciate your attention. I will be here for a panel of questions later today. Thank you very much.
And Del Haven Nursing Homes, part of the Lutheran Ministry Association of St. Louis. And Chaplain Watson is going to share with us his perspective on the African-American older adult. Let's welcome Chaplain Watson.
Good morning. It is still morning. I would like to thank you for allowing me to be your speaker for this morning. As you see, there are handouts being handed to you. We are going to endeavor to do several things here. First, we're going to speak to you, and then we'd like to share with you some things concerning what we call a Caleb's Ministry, which is a volunteer program that we are initiating in this area for the benefit of increasing more volunteers in the in our nursing home ministry. And then, if possible, we would give you some songs that we sing in our pastoral care, and we will, if we have time, we will go just sing one or two of them, so that you can get some idea of what we do in African American music and how we carry on there at the nursing home. First, I'd like to say that it is an honor and a privilege to talk to you about something that is very dear to my heart. The pastoral care to the older adult in general, and then most specifically pastoral care to the African American, to my people, which I am a part of. First, I'd like to tell you something about myself. My name is Chaplain Watson, as I've already been introduced. My wife's name is Carol, and she's here with us over there. And we have 6 children and 10 grandchildren. Our latest grandchild is named Matthew, and Matthew is very far removed from the gospel. I did my studies at the Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and graduated in 1984. My first call was to my hometown, East St. Louis, Illinois. Has anyone ever heard of that city? To the Unity Lutheran Church there, and at that church I discovered that even though it was predominantly black, I found out that 80% of its members were over the age of 60. And so I realized just how important the ministry to older adults really is. I went into the local nursing home there and started a ministry to them, and I found out that I really enjoyed working with older adults. And then from there, I now see how important it is that we be with them in their problems and in their troubles. I decided even further my ministry, even in the after 10 years of in 3 pastorates, I decided to take a course in what we call clinical pastoral education. And my supervisor is here with us this morning, Joe Hempel. And from that, I was able to relate with the sufferings and the pains of others. And to see, clinical pastoral education also enabled me to do counseling, to sharpen and create counseling skills whereby you can get right down with people, where you can get into their minds and to know exactly what they were thinking, which was so important when dealing with African Americans. Also, it gave us the opportunity that we who had been marred and scarred in the past could also come forth and become the heal us with the remedies for the future. We become the wounded healer. I read this book is from the Dr. Henry J. Nguyen, and he writes a good article on the wounded healer. Those who have been wounded can also become healers. Now, my present call is with the Lutheran Ministries Association, whereby I am a chaplain, and I am assigned two nursing homes. There's the Del Haven Nursing Home and also the Tower Village Nursing Homes, which are in the North St. Louis area. Both these nursing homes are Medicaid, Medicare certified. And by that I mean that the government underwrites the cost of the beds that are there. Otherwise, it would be impossible for the residents to stay there because of the spiraling cost of nursing home care. With the Lutheran Ministries Association, I am very, very happy to be a part of this team. Now, while there are many images and there are many illustrations, types, and metaphors about God, yet there's one that stands out. There's one common thread that seems to unite all of the images. There is one specific truth that continues to manifest itself day in and day out and throughout the whole entire Bible. And that is that God cares for all of his creatures. I am very impressed with the statement that was put out from the Theology of Church Relations concerning racism. And it says, adopted as a theme, whether yellow, red, black, or white, all are precious in his sight. I think that is the essence of pastoral care, that God cares for all of his creatures. Now, when we speak of pastoral care, we're not just speaking about just the level of a pastor seeing his members, but we're talking about the whole entire community coming together so that a spiritual needs are met and that the whole person is ministered to in a holistic fashion. I have found out that there are four functions in pastoral care. First, there is the healing aspect. The binding of the wounds, our Lord tells us that he had come to bind the wounds and that he had come to set captives free. Through the healing aspect, there are damages that are being repaired by disease and infection and those things that had been lost in the beginning. And then there is the sustaining effort. The help that a person receives that enables them to be able to courageously and intuitively endure whatever situation comes upon them. It gives them that power to transcend whatever problems may be coming. And then there's the guiding principle that makes the individual know that he has a choice, that he can take other alternatives in solving his problem. Then there's the reconciliation, whereby broken relationships are brought together again, relationships with God and also relationships with man. I have found that even though there are four that principles that are put forth or four elements that are used in pastoral care, yet when it comes, in my experience, when it comes to the African American, It's something altogether different, people. I can see that there is the healing, the sustaining, the guiding, and the reconciliation. But I can only apply two of these to the African American, to my people. Sustaining and guiding. When I think about sustaining, I think about the giraffe. Just the giraffe. The giraffe is born and he gets to the height of 19 feet. And its baby at birth is not able to walk, as we know. But the mother of the giraffe, she takes her baby and she straddles that baby. And she takes her own body and gently bring it together, sustains it, and from her body she guides it, and she sets it in the direction that she wants it to go. That is sustaining. Without any preconceived idea, without any vindictiveness or judgment, she realizes that this is a baby, and he can't make it by himself. I have to guide it, I have to lead it, I have to sustain it. And in 2 hours' time, that baby is walking and able to go to wherever it wants to go, simply because its mother was there to pull it together and to keep it going. And my friends, I see myself, my people, the African Americans, I see them in that same situation. And why will it be that way? There has been a situation that has caused that. For the need of always being sustained, never being healed, never really being reconciled, but always having to be carried, always having to be nurtured, always having to be sustained. Now, what would that be in the history of our life and my people? There has been the very institute of slavery and racism, discrimination, and also prejudice. These are injuring factors. The African American, even though in church and even though wanting to be able to, really wanting to enjoy the healing factor, yet he only is sustained because a healing sometimes is just virtually impossible. Many come from a background of low self-esteem. It was Dr. Dobson who says that self-esteem is an essential part of anybody's development. And he says that also that whenever a one feels disrespect from another, then he is engulfed with low self-esteem. That is the problem with many African Americans. How can I have the healing, are they saying? How can I actually have the reconciliation that is needed when my spirit has been so wounded and when I have been considered not to be a person, and racism and prejudice stands before me every day? So therefore, I can see only the sustaining. How am I sustained? I am sustained by the total caring community of the church. The total caring community. In other words, African Americans many times go to church just to be uplifted by each other. I see it in the nursing homes when, even now, in some of my people, when they are hurt and they feel that nobody cares, then the caring community gets around them and let them know that we love you, we care for you. And so that is the way it is when dealing with African Americans. Also, there is that factor that lets them know that even though that it seems that there is no healing, yet there is guidance. There is a guidance factor that enables me to cope with whatever has happened to me. It gives me different alternatives whereby I will be able to solve my own problems. And how can that be? How will I be able to solve my problems? First, we have to realize that the greatest and the most pastoral person we ever know would be Jesus Christ. He is the answer to all of our problems. But his ministry was a holistic ministry. That is, that he ministered to the whole person. Yes, your spirit is broken and your mind, your psychological development is impaired. But yet, he says, I see you. I see African-American people as people that are worth a saving, people that are worth loving, and people that are worth dying for. That's the way our Lord did. He did not look upon the color of one's skin. He did not look upon one's personality. He did not even look upon a person's ability, but yet he was able to save, and he was able to say, come to me. Come to me, all of you. It doesn't matter. It's just like the church theology says, whether black or white, bond or free, all are precious in his sight. And he proves it because he loves us all, one and all. Jesus, the greatest caregiver that we can ever know. And so as the pastoral caregivers, we sometimes forget about what are before us. We forget about the different backgrounds that people, many times in the nursing home, bring with them. They are not always the same. But sometimes they go reflect back into the future and think about things that have happened. I recall one that came to me and was telling me about their situation. And they were crying, and I said, what is wrong? And they told me that the brother, their grandson, had been shot. As an African American and coming up in the ghetto and being in poverty, I can identify with violence, and I can identify with pain. And she says that her child grandson had been shot. I walked up to her and I saw her slump. She was slumped over. And I put my arms around her. But you see, I know what she was talking about, because even in my family, in my background, there are so many evidence of violence and so many times that a pain that even I, as a caregiver, I have to suffer myself. Gunshots and acts of violence that African Americans just see as commonplace. In my case, I could feel her pain because my wound again was open. My father, my stepfather, had also experienced. My father and stepfather both had experienced gunshot wounds. My uncle was shot, one fatally, and burned. And in addition, my brothers, I had two brothers, both were wounded by gunfire. My aunt was shot to death. My best friend was also fatally wounded. So I knew the pain and the suffering that she was going through. And that is what it is in caregiving. And in our ministry, we have to be there in order to know what it is that people are suffering, what people are going through. There There's racism, there are acts of violence, and there are also acts of racism. This is another account that was given that I experienced. A lady, I won't call her name, her name is Miss Red, a 60-year-old female, suffered from strokes, seizures, and loss of memory. Miss Red recently married one of the residents at the nursing home about 4 years ago. Mrs. Red gives this account of an early childhood experience of sexual abuse by several of her relatives. Miss Red now considers herself, because of that, immoral and lewd. She even agreed with those who would, her peers that would call her bad names. And because of her low self-esteem, she says, yes, but I can't help it. Many times I have talked to her and she has said that I want to kill myself because I don't feel like I don't want to live in this place and continue to hear the abuse that I'm yet taking. She was in need of spiritual healing. She was in need of spiritual care because inwardly she was accepting the ideals that people had brought to her, that they had said about her. But now, in working with her and in giving her therapy, she's doing just fine now. But every now and then, she will lapse into that same a mode of feeling that nobody cares and that she's not worth anything. There's another incident here. I was showing the seminarians around in our nursing home facility. And we went to the door, went past the door of Mrs. Blue. Mrs. Blue is a 97-year-old female. Mrs. Blue is sometimes suffer from senility. When you see her sitting on the, when you see her sitting out her door, she's back in Arkansas. And she's ready for somebody to come to take her home. But Mrs. Blue, when she came, as she grabbed one of the seminarians by the hand, and she began to talk to them. And this quote is exactly what she said. She says, "If you call us niggers, and we call you crackers," she says, "my mother was a slave of your people, and you have been free all the time." Then she says, "Whether I am a nigger and you a cracker, whether my people were slaves and yours free, if we want to please God, we must love one another." And then all three of us, both me and the seminarians, all of us threw our arms around her, because even though there was pain, yet there was healing. Ministry to African Americans has to be taken into account that these people come, all of us, we come from backgrounds of poverty, of violence, and from uncertainty. At times, there were times when neither one, when we did not know where a meal was coming from. There were times when we saw that of all I was doing, nothing was good enough. In ministering to African Americans, we must always remember that that sustaining factor goes on all the times. And then we have worship, which they love, and the nursing home, they love the worship. They love to sing the songs, and they love to really let themselves go. That was the only sustaining factor that the slaves would have had a long time ago. But they would come to church, and they would shout, and they would thank God that they were able to make it through another day. And so, even in the nursing home, I find that music, the music, African-American music, really soothe the soul, and they let themselves go emotionally, whatever you want to call it. It is their way of expressing their love for God and their love for one another. The song, Before I Be a Slave, I'll Be Resting in My Grave, and Then I'll Go Home to My Lord and Be Free. I think about a poem that I read once, and it was called The Little Black Boy by William Blake, an English writer at that, and he says like this. He says, "My mother bore me in the southern wild, and I am black, but oh, my soul is white." He's as white as an angel is the English child, but I am black as if bereaved of light. And he says that my mother taught me under a tree, and she would point to the east, and she would begin to say, "Look there, my boy, on the rising sun, for there God does live, and he gives his light and his heat away, and all of we receive joy in the morning and comfort in the noonday. And these black bodies and sunburnt face are but a cloud, like to a shady grove." He says, "Thus my mother said to me, and this is what I said to English boy, that when I from my black cloud and he from his white cloud free, and all of us around the throne of God like lambs rejoice, then I will arise and I will shade him from the heat, and then till he can learn to bear in love upon my father's knee, and I will be like him, and he would then love me." William Blake is saying, all the only time that we will see really true equality is the time when God takes us into his kingdom and we all become one. Thank you.